Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Sunday edition of the Daily Nonpareil for Sunday, June 6, 2021. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. On the front page is an article by Tim Johnston titled, Preservation Iowa Honors Bluffs for Restoration of Harvester II, Creation of Hoff Family Center. The Hoff Family Arts and Culture Center was honored with a Preservation at its Best Award for the restoration of the Harvester II building. The award for Best Community Effort was presented during a virtual ceremony at the Preserve Iowa Summit. 11 projects in 7 communities were honored with Iowa's highest awards for historic preservation during the summit. The annual conference is presented by the State Historic Preservation Office, which is part of the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs. In addition, the nonprofit group Preservation Iowa presented its Preservation at its Best awards in 5 categories during the same ceremony. These annual awards honor properties and educational efforts that meet the highest standards of preservation practices. Quote, Iowans across the state can take pride in this year's winning projects, said Bruce Perry, president of Preservation Iowa's Board of Directors. Quote, all are fine examples of historic preservation that serve as models for future preservation work in Iowa and beyond, end quote. Pottawatomie Arts, Culture, and Entertainment spearheaded the transformation of the historic warehouse into a 95,000-square-foot arts center. Ground was broken on June 1, 2018, and a ribbon cutting was held at the center on March 13, 2020. The facility features a theater, culinary arts kitchen, teaching kitchen, exhibit gallery, dance studios, art studios, classrooms, and more. Quote, it was a large project driven in no small part by the Iowa West Foundation, Council Bluffs Mayor Matt Walsh said. But there were many other funders, foundations, individuals, the county, and the city, end quote. Quote. The project also received some Iowa tax credits, he said. The community can be proud of the award, Walsh said. Quote, it was an award for the work of many citizens of Council Bluffs, he said. I honestly don't feel it's something I can take credit for. Aside from attending some meetings and making a small donation, I didn't do anything. The city did donate and continues to donate, end quote. A lot of people were involved in forming PACE and developing a concept for the facility, said Dr. Ted Hoff, retired ophthalmologist who, with his wife, donated $2 million to establish an endowment for its operation and served on the PACE Board of Directors during its first couple of years. Quote, I think by doing an arts center, they have packed a lot of resources in one location, he said. I think they have eliminated a lot of duplication. A lot of organizations were vying for the same grants for the same thing, end quote. Years of studies, focus groups, and planning went into the development of the center. Participants included representatives from the former Bluffs Arts Council, Chanticleer Community Theater, and other arts groups, many of whom became members of PACE's Board of Directors when it was officially established in July 2016. Funding for the $27 million facility came from the Iowa West Foundation, which donated $9 million over a period of years. Ted and Polly Hoff, $2 million, which was used to establish an endowment to help pay for operating costs, Bob and Paulina Schlott, $1 million, an enhanced Iowa grant for $1 million, the Darty Peter Kiewit Mutual of Omaha and Southwest Iowa Foundations, a combination of $2.3 million, John and Ann Nelson, who gave $500,000, Dick and the late Deanne Miller, who also chipped in $500,000, Cheryl Bills Taylor and the Galvani family, $250,000, ConAgra, $150,000, Elizabeth Collins, $125,000, and additional funding from historical state tax credits and other businesses and individuals. The front page of Sunday's Nonpareil focuses on 2 staff photos by Joe Shearer titled Rummage On Through. In the first, shoppers make their way across the arena floor during the annual rummage sale inside Reaver Arena at Iowa Western Community College on Friday. In a second picture, Dawn Trotter carries a microwave while shopping. This is the 5th year the rummage sale has been held, and the money generated from the event will benefit the women's basketball and volleyball programs. Women's head basketball coach, Lindsay Vandehove, organizes the sale each year, and she said it's a tradition she picked up while coaching at Lakeland University in Wisconsin before coming to Council Bluffs. She also said the programs, quote, pay it forward, end quote, to the community, as many leftover items will go to local organizations, such as blankets being donated to Midlands Humane Society and clothing going to the Care and Share House. Today is the final day of the rummage sale, that being Sunday, from 9 to noon. In another front page article, Tim Johnson writes, Heartland Family Service to honor Knadler at virtual fundraiser. Heartland Family Service will hold its 17th annual Strike a Chord event as a virtual so-called show at the COVID-19 pandemic eases. The event, with the theme on Broadway, will run from 6 to 9 p.m. on June 11th. The event will include a silent auction, which will open at 7 p.m. Monday and continue until 9 p.m. on June 11th, according to a press release from Heartland Family Service. Other highlights will include musical entertainment, a live auction, a raffle, and games. All proceeds will benefit Heartland's Southwest Iowa programs, including its K-12 therapeutic school, housing and support services for families experiencing homelessness, mental health counseling for children and their parents, and prevention, education, and treatment for substance use and problem gambling, the press release stated. This year's Salute to Leadership Award will be presented to Marie Knadler. Heartland Family Service is proud to honor her for her tireless efforts to improve the lives of the individuals, children, and families of Southwest Iowa. Knadler started as a nurse in Mercy Hospital's intensive care unit, then worked days and nights on med-surgical before transferring to the coronary care unit, where she later became the director. She worked in various nursing leadership roles at Mercy and in 1988 was promoted to vice president of nursing, according to a previous Nonpareil article. Several mergers occurred after 1995, and she was selected to serve as the chief operating officer of Mercy Hospital, as well as to other system roles in behavioral health, home care, and hospice, emergency services, and cardiology. In 2009, she continued as the president of Mercy and was at the same time appointed as president of Bergen Mercy. In 2016, she also assumed the role of president of Creighton University Medical Center and worked to merge Bergen Mercy and Creighton University Medical. She retired in February 2019. Throughout her working career with the Sisters of Mercy, Marie found many avenues to continue their ministry in the Council Bluffs community. She took many opportunities to lead and support nonprofit services. To name a few, began a free medical clinic with Dr. Charles Edwards on North 35th Street, the beginning of the federally qualified clinic in Council Bluffs, now known as All Care Health Center. Secured funding from the Iowa West Foundation for a behavioral health planning grant to form the Mental Health and Substance Abuse Coalition, which has now moved to provide regional delivery of mental health services. Worked with community leaders to form Wellness of Council Bluffs, which eventually merged with other nonprofits to form the 712 Initiative. With many community leaders, helped to form Hospice of Southwest Iowa, now part of the Visiting Nurse Association. As a founding board member of the Pottawatomie County Community Foundation, grew it to become a sustainable foundation for the future of Pottawatomie County and its citizens. Knadler also served in many leadership roles in other nonprofit organizations, including the Chamber of Commerce and Iowa Hospital Association. She and husband Michael Knadler have two sons, Jonathan and Jared. The honorary chairs for the 2021 Strike a Chord Gala are Kate Cutler and Boyd Luttrell. The couple are both very active in the Council Bluffs community. Cutler has served on the board of directors for the Iowa West Foundation, the Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission, and Habitat for Humanity of Council Bluffs, among other organizations. She also worked as an elementary teacher and later returned to higher education to become a lawyer. She strongly believes in basic human needs, especially adequate food, a stable place to live, medical services, and a voice to be heard. Luttrell is a Ph.D. sociologist and former Methodist minister who cares deeply about individuals and communities in which they live. He has a distinguished educational background and has taught at the University of Texas at Austin and the University of Nebraska at Omaha. He has a special heart for the impoverished, underserved, or otherwise challenged, and seeks to give voice to them and to help them overcome conditions that hamper their capacity for change. Since 1875, Heartland Family Service has responded to the needs of the area's most vulnerable children and families. In 2019, the agency connected with over 60,000 individuals and families through its direct services, education, and outreach. Its programs serve individuals of all ages, from infants in its Family Works program to seniors in its Generations Community Center. It operates from more than 15 locations in East Central Nebraska and Southwest Iowa. Heartland provides critical human services to the individuals and families who ultimately shape the future of the community through the following program areas: child and family well-being, counseling and prevention, and housing, safety, and financial stability. To buy a ticket for Strike Accord, register for the silent auction, and or bid on items or make a donation, visit Heartland's website at heartlandfamilyservice.org. In regional news, Jessica Wade of the Omaha World Herald writes, "Louis the Elephant moved from Omaha Zoo to North Carolina." Louis the Elephant recently made a 1,200-plus-mile trip from Omaha's Henry Dorley Zoo and Aquarium to his new home at the North Carolina Zoo. The 18-year-old African bull elephant's departure was announced Thursday and comes a few months after the Omaha Zoo's announcement that African elephant Claire is expected to give birth early next year. Claire is pregnant by Cali, who came to Omaha about 2 years ago from the Birmingham Zoo in Alabama in hopes that he would breed with the Omaha Zoo's 5 female elephants. Louis arrived in Omaha from the Toledo Zoo in Ohio in 2017. At the time of his departure to Omaha, Louis was regarded by staff at both zoos as a model elephant, despite a 2010 incident that injured his keeper. The keeper, since retired, violated protocol by entering the enclosure alone and suffered punctured lungs and fractured ribs after he appeared to startle the elephant. Zoo officials said Thursday that Louis was never involved in an aggressive incident while at the Omaha Zoo and that his move to North Carolina was based on a recommendation by the African Elephant Species Survival Plan through the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. Louis arrived at his new home May 25th and is settling well into his new habitat, according to a press release from the North Carolina Zoo. Nancy Kaufman, the zoo's animal management supervisor, said the elephant team is excited to welcome Louis to their herd. Quote, "He has been great and is making the transition well. We are thankful to have an Omaha keeper with us to teach us all of his quirks, and she has taught us so much already about this handsome guy," Kaufman said. And in an article from Iowa Farmer Today, Lewis couple, master pork producers, happy with so-called unexpected farm career. Mike Marshall certainly did not think he would end up making a career in the pork industry. He planned to enlist in the Marines between his junior and senior years at Glenwood High School. But the Marine Corps had some bad news for the Southeast Iowa teenager. Quote, "I didn't pass the physical," Marshall says. "I was going into my senior year without any idea of what I was going to do," end quote. His parents and grandparents owned a farm near here in Cass County. Marshall knew some about farming, so when a neighbor died, his family approached the youth about taking over the farm. Quote, "I started farming before I got out of high school," he says. "We had moved here from Glenwood, so I made the 100-mile round trip each day to school, then went back to work." Quote, "I'm not sure I knew what I was doing. I hadn't planted a row of corn my entire life," end quote. That was 1986. He married his wife Tracy in 1992, and in 1998, the couple started finishing pigs for the Murphy Brown Smithfield. After working with a few other systems, they began working with the Audubon Manning Veterinary Clinic 5 years ago. The couple was named a 2020 Master Pork Producer by the Iowa Pork Producers Association. They own 3 barns with a 1,100 head capacity. All the barns were built in 1998 and are emptied 2.5 to 3 times per year. They also grow corn on about 750 acres. Tracy grew up around pigs as her father farrowed sows. Their son Casey also helps out on the farm and works at Lindeman Tractor in Atlantic, and Mike works part-time for a nearby co-op. The couple has 2 other grown children. Tracy manages the kitchen at the Creighton University Retreat Center near Griswold. The facility recently reopened after closing due to COVID-19. Quote, "I could not do this without her," Mike says. "She's amazing," end quote. In addition to the row crop and hog operations, the Marshalls own a tank and agitator, using it to apply manure to their own fields as well as a few neighbors. Both Mike and Tracy said it is important to be active in their community. They are members of the Iowa Pork Producers and Iowa Corn Growers Associations. As Iowa Farm Bureau members, they served 3 years on the State Young Farmer Advisory Committee, served 15 years on the Cass County Farm Bureau Board, and received the Young Farmer Achievement Award in 1994. They are active in a local Bible study, provide donations to local fire departments, and have been involved with the 4-H, FFA, and school activities. Mike spent 12 years as a volunteer wrestling coach. Quote, "I loved wrestling, but I've had a bunch of surgeries and it just got too difficult," Mike says. "I miss it," end quote. While he admits that agriculture was not his first choice for a career path, Mike says he feels blessed to have become a farmer. Quote, "We really have enjoyed raising pigs, and we love working with AMVC," he says. "It's been hard work for sure, but we're happy with how things worked out," end quote. Another article in Sunday's Nonpareil is from Iowa Farmer Today, entitled "World Pork Expo Returns to Iowa State Fairgrounds." After a 2-year hiatus caused by foreign animal disease concerns and the COVID-19 global pandemic, the World Pork Expo returns to the Iowa State Fairgrounds in Des Moines Wednesday through Friday. Quote, "This will be the first expo since 2018, and it feels really good to be back," said Doug Frick, Director of Trade Show Marketing for the National Pork Producers Council. Quote, "Our board took a hard look at everything, and they felt this was the right move for everyone involved," end quote. Much of the expo remains the same as 2018, but there have been concessions made to COVID-19. That includes the absence of a live hog show, Frick said. However, the trade show has sold out when it comes to indoor space. Frick said the outdoor portion of the trade show has expanded, providing ample opportunities for producers to talk to an assortment of vendors. Quote, "We are continuing to add vendors outdoors. We have room to grow there," he said. Pork Academy and corporate-sponsored educational seminars remain an integral part of the expo. Frick said he is pleased with this year's lineup, which includes sessions on labor challenges, industry technology, sustainability, and climate impact. Quote, "There is going to be a lot of great information available to those who attend the expo," he said. The popular Big Grill has changed locations, moving to just west of the Jacobson Exhibition Center. Frick said the new location is, quote, "much more conducive for a large group of people," end quote. He said biosecurity protocols will be enhanced, adding hand sanitizing stations will be located throughout the expo area. Frick said NPPC will continue to monitor guidelines involving masks, etc. Quote, "We want to make sure that we're doing all we can to keep people safe," he said. More information on the World Pork Expo may be found online at worldpork.org. In education news, Tim Johnson writes, Council Bluffs Schools honor 2021 Employees of the Year. Council Bluffs Community School District announced its Employees of the Year last week. The honorees include Todd Offord, Network Specialist, 2021 Support Staff Member of the Year, Terrence McGurran, TradeWorks Instructor at Thomas Jefferson High School, 2021 Licensed Staff Member of the Year, and Bridget Bellows, Principal at Abraham Lincoln High School, 2021 Principal of the Year. Offord, who has been with the district for 33 years, is a, quote, "problem solver and troubleshooter," end quote, according to the person who nominated him. Quote, "In the buildings, we know Todd as the go-to person for our phones, bells, and security cameras," the person wrote. Quote, "It is not just what Todd does for us in our front offices, but also what he does behind the scenes that makes him so deserving of this honor." On Christmas Eve this school year, ALHS experienced a power outage where one of the main internet connections in the district is located. Todd spent the next 12 hours, yes, on Christmas Eve, securing the building and getting generators up and running. End quote. Offord, like other staff, has made so-called heroic efforts during the pandemic, his nominator wrote. Quote, "He was instrumental in setting up the drive-through Chromebook repair depot," the person wrote. "Todd built the decontamination room, including a drop slot, staging area, and quarantine room for the health and safety of our staff and families," end quote. Offord has also played an important role in the renovations of Kern and Wilson Middle Schools. Quote, "At Kern, Todd assisted the security contractor, made sure the heating and air contractor had connectivity, and that all the additions were added to the security camera system," the person wrote. "At Wilson, he removed more than 9.5 miles of outdated low-voltage cable and has installed 40,000 feet of new cabling to ensure internet connectivity and to operationalize the new security system. Quote, "Finally, it is worth noting that Todd has served our country for many years in the Army National Guard. He has been deployed many times, and we are grateful he chooses to also be part of our school district," end quote. Terrence McGurran, who has been with the district for 4 years, has helped make the TradeWorks Academy launch successful, his nominator wrote. Quote, from planning and implementation of curriculum to hosting donors, the media, future students, industry partners, and even the governor of Iowa, Terrence has demonstrated his keen investment in students and their success after high school, the person wrote. McGurran recruited Nate Clausen to co-teach with him at TJ. Quote, together, they have spent countless hours creating lessons for each of the 5 areas of the academy and then refining them each year so that it is a seamless learning experience for their students. Quote, Terrence also works with students after school on their Skills USA projects and demonstrates his belief that the leadership and technical skills taught through this program will make students marketable in the industry, his nominator wrote. That has resulted in strong student participation in the program and many continuing their studies at Iowa Western Community College. Quote, thanks to the vision of Dr. Murillo, Dr. Rasik, the Board of Education, and Terrence, Council Bluffs is now a leader in skills training for high school students, the person wrote. Bridget Bellows has been with the district for 15 years and served as an assistant principal at Abraham Lincoln before being promoted to principal in 2015. Quote, Bridget Bellows is a true leader who walks the walk, her nominator wrote. She has a large knowledge base and is able to not only share information, but also model and teach it. She is collaborative, caring, and is an engaging colleague, able to establish and maintain quality relationships with students, staff, and families, end quote. Bellows is both empathetic and realistic, her nominator wrote. Quote, with her high expectations, she works to ensure students and staff have what they need to be successful, the person wrote. Quote, she is an advocate who always supports students and staff in their personal growth. She is trusted, solution-focused, and always keeps students and their success at the center of her work, end quote. On the opinion page of Sunday's Nonpareil, Aaron Murphy, who covers Iowa politics and government for Lee Enterprises, writes, "We need more governing, less campaigning. There's been too much campaigning and not enough governing taking place lately at the Iowa Capitol. It's not the only example, but the most recent one happened this week when Republican Governor Kim Reynolds and Democratic State's Auditor Rob Sand publicly traded accusations over Sand's audit of Reynolds' use of public funds for a COVID-19 public service announcement. The abbreviated version of the story goes like this. Sand's office filed a report that alleged Reynolds improperly used public funds to make the PSA, which featured the governor and other public figures encouraging Iowans to wear face masks to slow COVID-19 spread. Reynolds used $500,000 in federal pandemic relief funding on and appeared in the PSA. However, state law prohibits the governor and other state elected officials from using public funds to promote themselves. Shortly after the report was made public, Reynolds' office responded by noting state law allows for an exemption during a public health emergency. Sand's office then responded to the governor's response, essentially alleging that the governor needed to, in her public health emergency declaration, specifically waive the law that bars state executives from using public money to promote themselves. This gets a bit into the legal weeds, but the interpretation from Reynolds' office is that state law says a public health emergency declaration creates those exemptions without the need for each law to be specifically stated. Here's the bigger point. Much of this conversation, debate, disagreement, whatever you want to call it, could and probably should have taken place between the auditors and governor's staff before either one of them went public. Clearly, the auditor and governor have different interpretations of the state law in question. One option would have been for their respective staffs to hash some of that out between themselves before airing their dirty laundry for the public. In other words, they could have governed. I'm not assigning motives here, but this is happening against this backdrop. Reynolds likely will be running for re-election next year, and Sand has acknowledged he is weighing whether to run for governor. It does not take a giant leap in logic to question whether both parties were at least partially, if not entirely, motivated by politics in their handling of this report. Sand could have given the governor's office more time to respond to the report. Reynolds could have taken her disagreement with the report's findings to Sand first. Instead, both went quickly to the public. As a result, Iowans were subjected to a back and forth that sounded more fitting for a candidate debate stage in late October of next year and less like an honest disagreement between two state executives. In other words, they campaigned. Iowa Senator Pam Yoakum, a Democrat from Dubuque, often would say that candidates spend their entire time on the campaign trail as bitter adversaries, but once elections are over, they must focus on governing. Too often, it seems, that switch is no longer taking place. Elected officials appear to be having a harder time stepping off the campaign trail and onto the path to good governance, even after an election is well into the rearview mirror. That's not a recipe for good government. At some point, elected officials need to lay down their partisan swords and work for the greater good, not political points. Perhaps it's a naive dream in this politically polarized climate, akin to wishing DC Comics would straighten out its cinematic universe, but here goes anyway. Let's all hope, or even demand, that our elected officials remember more often to do their jobs instead of just trying to keep their jobs. And again, this is the opinion of Aaron Murphy, who covers Iowa politics and government for Lee Enterprises. The opinion page in Sunday's Nonpareil also includes a column by David M. Shribman, the former executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. His editorial is titled, What's in a Name? Up here in the White Mountains, things frequently aren't what they seem. The January showers in this Mount Washington Valley town often take their form as snowfalls in the high summits. The expert-rated Mount Maple Slalom ski trail on Black Mountain, just up the road from the Christmas Farm Inn, isn't as forbidding as its reputation. The Mount Clinton near the Presidential Range, peaks of Mount Adams, Mount Jefferson, Mount Madison, Mount Monroe, and Mount Eisenhower isn't named for Bill Clinton, and in any case often is called Mount Pierce. So no one should be surprised that for the past 2 weeks, the town of Jackson, population 891, no longer is named for the 7th president. And though the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs no longer bears the name of the university's one-time president, Woodrow Wilson, and though multiple facilities and programs at Tufts University no longer bear the name of the Sackler family, widely blamed for the opioid epidemic, you can still take out a book at the Jackson Public Library. Those who battle the town's intermittent blazes are still volunteer members of the Jackson Firefighters Association, and the fabled red-covered bridge across the Ellis River, perhaps the most picturesque in all of New Hampshire, still bears the carved wood sign saying it is the entryway to Jackson, New Hampshire. That's because the 5 dozen residents who attended an outdoor town meeting this month voted to change their community's name and yet to keep it the same. It no longer commemorates the memory of Andrew Jackson. It now celebrates the legacy of Charles Jackson, a one-time state geologist. The covered bridges, the public buildings, the postcards displaying images of a town that looks as if it belongs on a postcard, even residents' magazine address labels, none of that has to change. But the change that townspeople sitting on white folding chairs under a white tent beside the community center fomented is a sign of the times, or more properly, a story of how signs, statues, and place names commemorating colonial explorers and exploiters, Confederate heroes and even presidents are being altered in response to the nation's racial reckoning and its fresh understanding of the dark side of some of the country's founders, builders, and leaders. Jackson's name change is causing far less disruption than similar moves elsewhere. Port Elizabeth in South Africa, once named for the wife of a British colonial governor, now is known as Gubera Barrow. Barrow, Alaska, named for a member of the British Admiralty, is now known as Utqvik, which means, quote, a place for gathering wild roots, end quote, which is a pretty accurate description of the tiny community sitting where the Beaufort Sea meets the Chukchi Sea and where temperatures are at or below 0 degrees 160 days a year. Both were renamed as statements against colonialism. At least the residents of Jackson won't have to buy new stationery. In truth, name changes have been part of the culture of American history for centuries. The Mount Washington here in New Hampshire, still covered by a mantle of snow, once bore several names, including Agiokochuk, the native Abenaki's name for place of the storm spirit. The far smaller Mount Washington that looms over downtown Pittsburgh once went by Coal Hill. The Mount Pierce that was once called Mount Clinton had earlier been called Bald Hill. The Clinton who inspired its name until about a century ago was DeWitt Clinton, governor of New York, who ran unsuccessfully for president in 1812. The New Hampshire legislature thought the presidential range should include the state's only president, Franklin Pierce, who entered the White House in 1853 for a single term. That name now is under siege because the 14th president was a pro-slavery northerner who in his inaugural address argued that, quote, involuntary servitude, as it exists in different states of this Confederacy, is recognized by the Constitution, end quote. Adding, quote, I believe that it stands like any other admitted right, and that the states where it exists are entitled to efficient remedies to enforce the constitutional provisions, end quote. While Pierce's claim to the 4,311-foot peak may not survive the fresh examination of his record, the name of one of his predecessors, Andrew Jackson, has been expunged from this tiny town a 35-minute drive away. He's on his way out of the $20 bill also, and several Democratic state parties have removed his name from their annual fundraising dinners. Once championed as a great defender of the Union and the stalwart voice of the people, Jackson, regarded as a hero by liberals such as Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Lyndon B. Johnson, and conservatives such as Donald J. Trump, since has become a symbol of slavery and genocide. Quote, there's been a broad but not universal overturning of Jackson's reputation, said Daniel Feller, emeritus editor of the Jackson Papers at the University of Tennessee. Quote, by the 1970s, his reputation was being reevaluated because of the removal of Native Americans. Then his connection to slavery altered it further. End quote. In a town meeting here where residents deliberated on 11 topics, including passing a $2.4 million budget, raising $268,500 for a reserve fund for the fire department, a police cruiser, and an ambulance, and settled a controversy about fireworks in town, they also engaged in a debate about the legacy of Andrew Jackson. This debate pitted the two colliding arguments that the issue has spawned nationwide. Whether a figure such as Jackson should be reviled in our history, the argument proffered by Jerry Dougherty, who holds the title of assistant town moderator, or whether he should be judged by what Frank Benesch, who worked in finance before retiring, described to me as, quote, the standard of his own times, end quote. Town moderator Willis Kelly counted about 39 or 40 votes in favor of stripping Andrew Jackson from the town's name, with between 24 and 27 Jacksonians voting to retain the president's ties to the community. So today the town is named after the Jackson who completed a 19th-century geological survey of the Granite State. But there will be no movement to change the name of the 4,052-foot Mount Jackson in the presidential range. The mountain, with its summit along the Appalachian Trail, was named for the geologist and not the president in the first place. Again, this is the opinion of David M. Shribman. You are listening to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Sunday, June 6, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Now let's turn to Sunday's obituaries. Nancy L. Perkins, aged 85, passed away peacefully on Sunday, May 30th, at Country House Residence in Council Bluffs. She was born at the home located at 906 Oakland Avenue in Oakland, Iowa, on October 27, 1935, to Don and Willa Johnston Criswell. After she married Gail W. Perkins on November 3, 1951, the couple purchased her birth house and made it their home until moving to Council Bluffs in 2018. Together, they raised three sons and one grandson. Nancy loved her family, animals of all kinds, and the mountains of Colorado, where she fed chipmunks, Rocky Mountain, noisy birds, and any other animals that got close. She enjoyed attending events in which her children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren participated. She was a member of the First Congregational United Church of Christ, where she served on many boards and committees, and was also a Sunday school teacher. She also spent many hours volunteering at the Nishna Heritage Museum in Oakland. Nancy is preceded in death by her parents, Don and Willa Criswell, and her brother, Bill. She is survived by her husband of 69 years, Gail, sons, Donovan and Cynthia Perkins of Cincinnati, Ohio, Kevin Perkins of Omaha, and David and Donetta Perkins of Council Bluffs. Grandchildren, Jeremy Perkins of Oakland, Carrie Alfers of Lawrence, Kansas, Abigail Perkins of Council Bluffs,
Bryce Perkins of Houston, Texas, Jennifer McEnroy of Council Bluffs, and Michael Perkins of Cincinnati, and great-grandchildren Keaton, Casey, Logan, Savannah, and Camden. Private funeral services were held at 2 p.m. Thursday, June 3rd, at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Burial at Oaklawn Cemetery in Oakland, Iowa. Marion Maxine Fisher, age 90, of Council Bluffs, passed away June 2, 2021. Marion was born in Pearson, Iowa, on May 29, 1931, to the late Fred and Frieda Carlson Roberg. She graduated from Castaigne High School in Castaigne, Iowa, and attended Wayne State College in Wayne, Nebraska, where she received her teaching degree. After college, she taught school in Moorhead, Iowa, before moving to Council Bluffs, where she worked for the Council Bluffs school system as a substitute teacher. She also worked for Council Bluffs Credit Bureau and later retired from Quest in Omaha, Nebraska. Marion was a member of Church of Freedom in Council Bluffs. In addition to her parents, she was preceded in death by her brother, Bill Roberg, sisters Lucille Knutson, Marjorie Roberg, and the love of her life, Gary Pacey. Marion is survived by her daughters, Patty and Larry Cleaver, Pamela and Michael Newberry, Diane Parrott and Bill Dahlheimer, a son, Donnie and Becky Fisher, all of Council Bluffs, 19 grandchildren, 24 great-grandchildren, and many other families and friends. Visitation is Sunday, June 6th, from 2 to 3:30 p.m. at the Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home. Memorial service will begin at 3:30 p.m. at the funeral home. A private graveside service will be held at a later date. Memorials will be directed to the family. Stanley Eugene Dyson passed away peacefully on May 21st in Carson City, Nevada, at the age of 86. A business and civic leader, Stan guided development and growth of the Omaha Council Bluffs area in executive roles in banking and real estate, such as president of Midlands Corporation and then First National Bank of Council Bluffs. He was also generous with his time on hospital and school boards, fundraising, church programs, and the Chamber of Commerce. Born on a farm near the small town of Henderson, Iowa, Stan served in the Coast Guard and earned his bachelor's degree from the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Married for 57 years to childhood sweetheart Shirley, who died in 2013, they raised three children and were founding members of Faith Westwood Church in Millard, and later, longtime members of First Congregational Church in Council Bluffs. Always loyal Husker fans, Stan and Shirley attended home games together for almost 40 years. Stan the man, as he was known to many, was a true spirit and mentor. Yet no matter his accomplishments, he'd remark that he was, quote, just a farm boy from southwest Iowa, end quote. He is survived by his three children and their spouses, Robert and Janice of Walnut Creek, California, Bruce and PK of Mendon, Nevada, Marley and Chuck of Fairfield, California, as well as nine grandchildren and eight great-grandchildren. Celebration of Life events will be scheduled later in the Walnut Creek, California and Council Bluffs, Iowa areas. Contact Robin at janicestyle.com for more details. That concludes the obituaries in Sunday's Nonpareil. In sports news, Peter Huguenin writes, Reavers start nationals with win. Iowa Western's women's soccer team started the national tournament out on the right foot on Friday night with a 3-0 win in pool play over Monroe Community College in Evans, Georgia. Head coach Adam Sanchez said it might be the most impressive showing from the Reavers this season. Quote, I thought they were excellent tonight, he said. It was probably one of the best games they've played, I think individually and then collectively as well. It just seemed like everyone that went in just played their best game, so that was really fun to watch. They just played really, really well against a quality side. End quote. Laura Linares opened the scoring in the 12th minute on an unassisted goal. Ella Pelletier scored off an assist from Anna Hall in the 25th minute, and Ririka Kamimura stretched the lead to 3 in the 36th minute off an assist from Yoshiki Katadai. Goalkeeper Judith Goliveras had 3 saves. The Reavers were looking for more goals in the second half, but the Tribunes locked down on defense. Quote, we're always in search of the next goal, Sanchez said. That's our mentality. That's how we defend. If we're on the attack, we know we can't get scored on. We tried to get out. We tried to possess. We tried to get back to our game, but Monroe Community College just put us under a lot of pressure. Quote, we created a couple chances, but just couldn't put any away. And they just put us under a lot of pressure. They knew that if they lost, their season was over. They fought. Credit to our back line and credit to the group as a whole. They bent but never broke. Sanchez pointed to Kamimura, Kiradai, Mayu Inokawa, Laura Renares, and Barbara Russo as some of the key players that propelled Iowa Western to a win. Quote, it was just a great performance from the team and a classic game for us to put in our catalog, Sanchez said. It was a massive match for us. I thought the performance from the team was as good as we've ever seen from Iowa Western, end quote. In men's soccer, Austin Heinen writes, Reavers edge past Laramie County. NJCAA Division I, number one Iowa Western, passed its first test in the NJCAA National Tournament by edging out Laramie College 1-0 on Saturday morning at Stryker Complex in Wichita, Kansas. After a 12-day hiatus, the Reavers returned to the field for their first game in the NJCAA National Tournament. With about 20 seconds to spare in the first half, Ivan Collado scored the game's only goal to win their first round game in the NJCAA National Tournament. Quote, it was a hard-fought 1-0 win. We were happy to take the 3 points and get out, Reavers coach Mike Brown said. Quote, sometimes it's just about surviving and advancing. We didn't play our best by any means, but we also knew the competition here was going to be great, and now we have that first win. Quote, we got the jitters out, we got a bunch of freshmen who have never played in nationals before, but we got the win, and now it's on to the next one, end quote. While the offense was hoping to win the game more decisively, the defense only allowed Laramie just 4 shots on goal, thus Brown was very pleased with how they pressured an experienced Golden Eagles team. Quote, initially, I think we got a bit frustrated, Brown said. The guys wanted to win the game by 5 or 10-0, but the teams here are here for a reason. Hats off to Laramie, they persevered and kept fighting. Our guys didn't back down either. Our defensemen did a great job. Diego Quintana and Kigo Tanaka were a couple of many who really played well. Our whole defense did a lot of great things to keep them in check, end quote. The Reavers will now prepare for number 6 LSU Eunice, which will be on Monday. A win in this game would guarantee the Reaver a spot in the national semifinal game against the lowest remaining seed. Game time against LSU Eunice is a set for 10 a.m. on Monday in Wichita. In prep baseball, Peter Huguenin writes, Titans pull away from Lynx late. Lewis Central and Abraham Lincoln battled back and forth on the baseball diamond Friday night at John Lieber Field for 4 innings, but a big 5th inning gave LC a 16-4 win. Lewis Central only held a 3-run lead after 4 innings before scoring 9 in the 5th to pull away and stay undefeated on the season. The Titans opened the game with a single run in the top of the 1st, and the Lynx offered with a run of their own. The same process repeated itself in the 2nd. LC scored 2 runs to gain some separation and took a 5-run lead in the top of the 4th. Quote, we got off to what I thought was a really slow start, Titans coach Jim Waters said. We eventually put the pedal to the metal as the game went on. We got some walk and some timely hits. Obviously, that kind of stuff never hurts anything. We also had a home run in that inning. We had a total of 14 batters come to the plate in that inning, which also doesn't hurt anything. Abraham Lincoln closed the gap to 3 in the bottom of the 4th before the big 5th inning ended the game. The Titans went 10 of 23 from the plate as a team with 5 singles, 2 doubles, and 3 home runs. Lewis Central finished with 12 RBIs and 13 stolen bases. Junior J.C. Dermody went 2 of 3 from the plate with 1 double and an RBI. He also scored 2 runs. Senior Luke Meyer also went 2 of 3 with 4 RBIs and 2 home runs. Senior Kale Malskite, junior Britton Bond, junior Aaron Harrington, and sophomore Casey Clare all recorded hits. Bond hit a home run. Quote, our goal every game is to get 10 hits or more, Waters said. Quote, the best part of that to me is 6 of those were for extra bases, which was great to see. We still got some lessons to take from this. We struck out 4 times and popped out 6 times, and we'd like to cut those numbers in half at least. quote, "We always want to have a tough presence with the bats, whether if it's a hard line drive and hitting it on the ground and forcing someone to make a play," end quote. Harrington started on the mound and earned the win. He allowed 4 runs, 3 of which were earned on 4 hits while walking 4 batters and striking out 8. Junior Trenton Jeannette pitched the final 2 innings of relief, allowing no runs on 2 hits while striking out 3 batters. No stats for Abraham Lincoln were available at the time of publication. Emily Scheib of the Nonpareil reports hot summer temps continue in the area. In the forecast, according to the weather service for the next few days, Monday will be mostly sunny with a high near 90 and a south wind of 6 to 10 miles per hour with gusts as high as 18 miles per hour. Monday night will be mostly clear with a low around 69. On Tuesday, the Council Bluffs area looks forward to a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms after 1 p.m. Tuesday will be sunny with a high near 92. In Sunday's Lifestyle and Community section, Emma Schwaller of the Council Bluffs Convention and Visitors Bureau writes, "Exploring Home, Summer Fun in Pottawatomie County." Looking for something fun, unique, and safe to do this summer? There are lots of great options in Pottawatomie County. I've listed some summer activities below that will allow you to relax, discover something new, and reconnect with your friends and family in an exciting and meaningful way. There's so much fun to be had in Pottawatomie County that I couldn't fit it all in one blog. Stay tuned, I will be sharing more things to do this summer on the What Away Iowa Facebook and whatawayiowa.com in the coming weeks. Antique shopping in Walnut. In 1985, Walnut was given the official title of Iowa's Antique City. You will find over 10 locally owned and operated antique shops where you can shop for collectibles, vintage items, and so many treasures you didn't know you needed. While you shop, don't forget to follow the Walnut mural tour. Make a whole day of it by eating a meal downtown in between shopping. There are several places to choose from, including B&L Diner, Glenn's Food and Pub, and Robert's Bakery Treats. Explore the arts. Pottawatomie County is home to numerous talented artists, and you can find their work at several locations throughout the rural communities. Back Alley Barn Quilt Project in Walnut. Barn quilts are a popular form of folk art that has been around for many years. In the last few decades, they have become increasingly popular in rural communities. To brighten up the alleys in Walnut, 9 quilt blocks were installed on the buildings of various shops east and west of Antique City Drive. Make it your mission to see all 9. Nishna Heritage Museum mural in Oakland. Covering the entire outer wall of the Nishna Heritage Museum, you will find a spectacular mural created by Malvern artist Zach Jones titled Time. It depicts scenes from the local area and has a nearby garden, picnic seating, and other public art. It is the perfect oasis for a picnic meal or a casual stroll. The Painted Camel Gallery in Macedonia. The Painted Camel is a fine art gallery and gift shop located in downtown Macedonia. The gallery features and sells the work of over 32 artists from the Midwest. They have pieces for all price ranges and styles. Pottery, painting, jewelry, sculptures, and many other forms of art can be found here. Volkswagen Beetle Spider in Avoca. One of Pottawatomie County's most unique and unexpected art pieces is the Volkswagen Beetle Spider in Avoca. The sculpture is made from an old VW bug and other metal parts. Stand under the spider if you dare. And wine the day away. Nothing is more relaxing than sipping some Iowa wine on a warm summer night. In recent years, Iowa has seen a resurgence of wine production and increasing interest from the wine-loving public. Stop by the 2 wineries in Pottawatomie County to enjoy some of the Los Hills' best. Breezy Hills Vineyard and Winery in Minden. The winery and vineyard location is a scenic and peaceful one where you can relax and enjoy the wine and hospitality. The views are breathtaking and change with the seasons, and yes, there is almost always a breeze. Inside the winery, roughly 2 dozen wines are fermented each year, providing various palates soothing choices ranging from dry reds to sweet whites, fruit wines, and even a traditional bottle method sparkling wine to choose from. Prairie Crossing Vineyard and Winery in Trainer. The vineyard is worked by hand from spring pruning to fall harvest because great wine starts in the vineyard. Prairie Crossing offers several grape wines, from light and fruity to a robust peppery red. Give them a try to pick your favorite. Grown in Iowa, made in Iowa, enjoyed anywhere. The fun doesn't stop there. Pottawatomie County is home to several outstanding recreational opportunities, like floating down the West Nishnabotna River Water Trail, hiking through the Los Hills at Hitchcock Nature Center, or trying out the weekly taco ride on the Wabash Trace Nature Trail. Visit waterwayiowa.com for more things to do in Pottawatomie County this summer. Eugenia Last's astrograph for those born Monday, June 7th. Set high standards, control your emotions, and study every possibility before taking action. Plan and negotiate fairly, and you will find common ground with like-minded people. Use your ingenuity, think outside the box, and know your capabilities. Everything will turn out as planned. And if you were born under the sign of Gemini, celebrating your birthday between May 21st and June 20th, take care of your responsibilities first. Refuse to let anyone or anything sidetrack you. Follow through with your plans and put everything in place for what you want to achieve this week. In Sunday's Sense and Sensitivity column by Harriet Cole, job seeker seeks interview tips. Dear Harriet, I finally got an interview with a company that I've been interested in since I was in high school. I know that if I don't get this job, it's going to discourage me from looking anywhere else, so I am trying my absolute hardest to secure my place at this company. How can I make myself stand out in a job interview? Signed, Job Hunting. Dear Job Hunting, it's time to refine your storytelling skills. Think about why you have wanted to work for this company and build a compelling story around that to share in your interview. Be specific. What about the company appeals to you? And most important, why are you the best fit for the job? Employers hire people because they can fulfill the company's needs and because they like the candidate and believe that they will be an asset to the company. Think about what will make you an asset: your skill set, your knowledge of their industry, your personality, your values, your work ethic. Be prepared to give examples of what type of employee you are. Finally, choose to be encouraged by how you are showing up for this interview. Do your very best and see how it unfolds. If you do not get the job, keep up your energy and offer all of your enthusiasm to the next opportunity. You can do it. One of the letters in the Jean Phillips Dear Abby column begins, Dear Abby, we are part of a close group of six couples who have a great time together. Although our political philosophies and worldviews are different, we have always have adult and stimulating discussions. The problem is, one of the couples doesn't believe in the COVID vaccination. We'd like to have a barbecue, but only with those of us who have been vaccinated. Is there a way we can do this without hurting the feelings of that couple? Signed, Ready to Socialize, but... Dear Ready, it depends on whether they feel the same way regarding wearing masks and social distancing. Diplomatically discuss your concerns with this couple. It would be better than excluding them and having them find out about it later. And it wouldn't be the Sunday paper without something from the comics. The Peanuts cartoon, featuring good old Charlie Brown, drawn by Charles Schulz, features Snoopy, dressed as a scout, leading a line of several Woodstock birds, also dressed as scouts. Snoopy's thoughts. Here's the world-famous Beagle Scout leading his troop on a nature hike. At this point, we will separate. Each will go his own way. We will meet back here in 45 minutes. In the next panel, he's saying to the birds as they walk away, this will teach and promote self-reliance. Suddenly, they're clustered around his feet, and Snoopy thinks, that was a short 45 minutes. Just for that, we're going to try it again as he sends them off, and I don't want to see anyone hanging around my feet. In the final pane, Snoopy is looking up where all of the birds are perched on his hat. Sunday's Garfield cartoon depicts John wearing bright red swim trunks and walking with a smile on his face toward a purple and yellow wading pool. As he dips his first toe into the pool, it begins to rain. He looks up, and with his hair completely besotten, he turns around and walks back toward the house. Still dripping, he exclaims to Garfield, it's raining too hard to get into the pool. And Garfield thinks, right, you wouldn't want to get wet.
And that does it for today's reading of the Sunday Council Bluffs Nonpareil for Sunday, June 6th, 2021. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org.
Thank you for listening.